Hi, everyone, and welcome back to In a Click. I'm your host, Jamili, and it's been a hot minute since our last episode, but I'm so beyond excited to be back and to introduce you to our two incredible guests, Dr. Robert Hieronymus and Laura Kortner, the authors of It's All in the Mind, Inside the Beatles' Yellow Submarine, Volume 2, which is a book written about the film The Yellow Submarine. So for listeners who have never seen or have not seen Yellow Submarine recently, you will definitely want to watch the film again to help you understand this conversation. Or after the interview, go take a fresh look at the movie, which is streaming now on iTunes. You can also access the book at yellowsubmarine.com. In the meantime, though, I hope you love our conversation as much as I did. Enjoy, and remember, love is all you need. Today, I've invited Dr. Bob and Laura to join us to chat about their new book, It's All in the Mind, Inside the Beatles' Yellow Submarine, Volume 2. So welcome, Laura and Bob, and thank you so much for being here.
Well, we're very happy to be here.
We are. Thank you for having us.
First, I want to congratulate you, of course, on writing such a creative and enthralling book. I'm quite glad you decided to write a second volume because, for me, it's unveiled a few mysteries that otherwise would have remained hidden. And one quote from Bob in particular really spoke to my experience watching the film a second time. So, Bob, you wrote, "I can quite distinctly remember that after the movie started, I became hypnotized. My eyes couldn't possibly stray from the screen. My whole consciousness was riveted. I had completely lost my will. It seemed to me that I had actually seen the whole picture before at another time. Everything seemed so familiar. The colors, the patterns, the symbols seemed to be allowing me to travel in time. A time of the forgotten past, tens of thousands of years back. How could it be?" So the justification for writing the first book is quite obvious to me, but I wonder what motivated you to write a second book about this 50-year-old cartoon?
Well, it's because we started hearing from about 13 other people that said, "Hey, what about us?" And we didn't know anything about them. And fortunately, that's when we decided, well, after 436 pages, it looks like we're going to add a few more on.
Yeah, it's true. We thought we had written the exhaustive history after 426 pages. Yeah. It does seem that way. And when we first started hearing from other animators, you know, that we had missed in the first round, we thought we were going to hear the same stories over and over again. And for a large measure, that was true. And we resisted for a long time. We don't need to publish anything more. You know, we started to collect interviews just out of courtesy. But then we met one animator who lives in Australia who has a terrific memory, better than most. And he had brought a camera with him into the studio. So he had all these wonderful candid shots of people working on the film that we hadn't seen before.
That's right.
And telling us stories we'd never heard before. And he put us in touch with a circle of others. And it gradually dawned on us that we really had to publish. They deserve to have their stories told as well. It's the younger set. So once we decided to do it, we also decided to include the stuff that got cut out of the volume one, which is Dr. Bob's more metaphysical conjectures and symbolic, personal, of course, subjective symbolic interpretation of the film. But it goes quite deep, as you know. Mm-hmm. And as we started writing all that down and collecting information from other animators, we started hearing from other fans who had also taken the film as deeply as you had.
That was the big surprise to me. You know, for me to get to the other level in the first book was hard enough. But then the struggle that you go through in trying to relocate and to document, I mean, really make sure you got it right. That's a hard thing to do, especially in the area of music and rock and roll and that kind of thing, because it all moves so particularly fast. It's like a quick Jimi Hendrix kind of thing happening on you all the time.
Yes. Well, I was just going to say that we, as we get teased sometimes for taking it too seriously, you know, that, as you said, it's a 50-year-old cartoon movie. How could you become so obsessed with it to write two whole books about it? But we're not the only ones. That's what I found great comfort in finding out. There were other fans who took it even deeper than you had. Into quantum theory and, you know, Goethe's color theory and Jungian theory, and it's wonderful, and it opens up your mind to all these possibilities, and you can see the film in a whole nother way. And you have to understand rationally that the artists had none of these intentions when they were putting these together. But there's a whole argument to be made for a lot of artists don't intend the deep meanings that are found in their work by the people who view them. That's a wonderful topic of discussion you can have with just about any artist. Or, you know, where the ideas come from dreams and from musing, from periods when you're not really you, you know, you're not in control of your brain or your mind or whatever it is where creativity comes from. So in this instance, when they were creating this film, first of all, there's a lot of cooks in this batter, right? There's a lot of cooks in this kitchen, almost 200 people contributing, probably 30 of them making all the conscious creative decisions and the rest filling in the colors, but still a lot of people involved in one project, you know, one product that it holds together as one cohesive whole is kind of remarkable in itself based on the way it was made. In a screaming panic, they had 11 months to complete something that should take 4 years. So all those things combined to make something that could not be recreated again under regular circumstances. And so therefore they were just grabbing whatever came to them. And we can interpret as we want, because I think that's what you should be doing with all great art. And it holds up to all kinds of interpretations.
Right.
You see, in the very beginning, we thought that these guys were conscious of what they were doing.
Well, first of all, that it was the Beatles.
And that was the Beatles, because we couldn't find out. I couldn't find out for the longest time who did what. And I was shocked because I gave all the credit to the Beatles.
Right.
And that was backwards, because they were not interested in getting this film done.
Really?
They, matter of fact, they really did not like it very much until they finally started to see some of it. And then they changed right away. They totally misjudged what was going on because of the series that was done before that. That first series?
Well, the cartoon on TV, the television cartoon. It's called The Beatles. And the animation is crude, and the storylines are very simplistic. They were basically churning out a new one each week, so you can't be too creative with that type of pressure. And it was just a money-making factory job that they would base it on songs, and it kept the Beatles very popular amongst the younger set for a long time.
But the Beatles didn't like it.
But yeah, they weren't impressed. And it was made, the movie was made by the same people.
Interesting.
They just got a lot better.
So what was, do we know what their qualm was with it? Like what was, why weren't they on board?
Oh, all kinds of reasons.
Well, one of the reasons dealt with the head chief who brought it in right now.
True. Al Brodax.
Al Brodax. Yeah. He was the key to this, because without Al Brodax from King Features, the guy with the heavyset guy with the big cigar, which they like to always...
Hawaiian shirts. They characterize.
Yes, they really.
Typical brash American producer type.
But he was totally insensitive to anything dealing with meaning and purpose and that kind of thing. So he really played it down. And the Beatles did not like him. And at one time, John Lennon was forced to write a song.
Well, I think, we make the argument that the song Hey Bulldog, which is not a really well-known song amongst the Beatles canon, for one reason is because it was made for this film. And so it got obscurely released on the film soundtrack and not a lot of airplay, but it's a really cool song. I like it. It's a very rocking number. It's unique. Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard. It's all Beatles songs are that, but in any case, if you listen to the lyrics, there's a couple of lines in there that make us think that he's talking about Al Brodax and his dislike for this producer. He's the typical suits against the artists. Because Al Brodax, give him credit, he, amongst lots of other people, came up with a way to make money off the Beatles. When the Beatles were at their mop top height of Beatlemania, he got this cartoon deal made, you know, and people were making bubblegum and, you know, all kinds of merchandising. Everything you could possibly think of. There was shampoo, you know, so the Beatles were licensed to sell everything. And he was just one of those. And so he cranked it out, as we said, and he used American actors, I think.
Yes.
To do fake British accents. That was one of the things they really objected to, these fake British accents.
Of course.
But it was just one of another thing. They just kept it at arm's length. So when they came to say, we're going to do a feature length film, which has much more staying power, longevity, it's it's more respectable. They said, no way, you cannot do a 90-minute version of that cartoon. It would be terribly embarrassing. So they had to go and find some avant-garde designer and assure them that the storyline would be more mature. Mm-hmm. And Al Brodax had to make all these promises that he eventually got them to do the film as well, by hiring somebody from Yale, professor of classics at Yale, to write the screenplay, which is why it has so many connotations for us. Like it follows the Joseph Campbell monomyth pattern, the story, the basic story outline. For those of you, if you haven't seen the film and you're listening to this interview, then you really need to stop now and go watch the film and then come back, because it won't make a whole lot of sense otherwise. Yeah. But the basic story is there's this utopia called Pepperland, which is what Bob was reacting to in that opening quote. Very similar to Atlantis, an underwater sort of sphere.
Very much so.
That is lots of music. There's a song in a park happening. And then they're attacked by these blue meanies, this army of creatures that are quite whimsical, actually, but terrifying in sound. And they hate the sound of music and they hate color. So they attack the utopia. And at the last minute, they send off the yellow submarine from the top of a pyramid, another connotation that struck Bob, since that's his doctoral dissertation is all about the symbol on the back of the $1 bill, not to take too far of an aside, but you know, the pyramid with the unfinished pyramid with the eye and the triangle on top of it. That's how he became Dr. Bob.
Well, it's one of my doctorates.
He's written a doctoral dissertation just on that symbol alone. So you see something like a radiant sun or an eye in a triangle or a yellow vehicle that flies on top of a pyramid shape, and it's the same sort of symbol. So you can interpret that to mean the same thing. Anyway, the submarine takes off in search of help, lands in Liverpool, picks up the Beatles. Those are going to be the heroes, takes them back through all these various strange seas, seas of illusion, ends up back in Pepperland and through a series of musical, magical love magic. It's a combination of all three. They vanquish their enemies. Now, that's a key point too. They don't kill their enemies.
That's right. That's the key to this film. There's no killing. There's no death. What they basically did was they elevated the consciousness of these beings through love. Even when their life was threatened, they decided to move in a positive direction rather than a negative direction. And that's the whole thing about love, because that's what love does. It is the cohesive force of the universe. It's not just here on this planet. It, as we will find out with the other beings that have been coming to our planet and what they're doing and looking out for us, because there are earth changes that they are watching over, and we need their help. They are much more advanced than we are. It's easy for them to see our auras. When they see our auras, they know what kind of people we are. You can't hide that. The aura does the whole thing. But if you're not that elevated in awareness, then you don't pay any attention to it, and that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So that aspect of it is really extremely important in this particular work, in thinking and elevating a consciousness of our country and elevating our consciousness of the world. And how we can do it is by bringing balance, especially in regards to the male-female unity, and not try to look at women as men and not men as women. Because right now we're beginning to understand we have many different types of half men, half women, one quarter girl, this, that one. It's because all beings have consciousness. This is something I had to learn. One of the amazing things I had to learn, I'm a student all the time, was about consciousness and animals. I had no idea that dogs, cats, lions, snakes, crocodiles, all these other beings have consciousness in a certain sense and are our friends. I know how corny this sounds, you know, but it is true. And it took me a long time. I've always loved animals, but I didn't know why. But to me, they seem so familiar, and in a way, a kind of a teacher. in some ways, you know, and so therefore I was like my wife, always looking out for whether you're going to step on an ant or step, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, because those kind of beings you don't think are relatively important and usually, but they are for some particular reason. We just don't know what that might be. Sorry to take so long.
That's okay. It's true. She goes to great lengths to save, you know, the mice that come into the pantry, she'll put a little nest out for them, or the ants, you know, she tries to send them out with a little trail of sugar. And she's written some books about it, White Spirit Animals, The Prophets of Change. And I know you talked about how that has woken you up to consciousness of not just animals, but rocks.
And now, yes. Boy, if that was
minerals,
what was that? That was the biggest breakthrough in my life, knowing that there is consciousness in rocks, stones, minerals. If you're going to get anything, get an emerald. Emeralds are healers, one of the greatest healers. As a matter of fact, and so is turquoise. I used to distribute as much turquoise as I possibly could. And later on in this book, if I don't know if you finished it, but they really worked when I used them with Heinz Edelman to keep him alive. That was my intense purpose because he was like my brother. We understood each other. I would show him my artwork for painted cars and he would say, "Bob, what are you doing painting a car? You know, you all these other great murals are doing, you're stuck painting a car." And I would say, more or less, it's a method by which I can communicate with people. Because like my one bus that I painted that went up to Woodstock and we just recreated the bus has a very important message and it's on the back of the bus. And it's shocking to a lot of people, except for women. It says,
you're going to ask me to say it?
Yep.
It says, "She is coming.
She is coming."
If you look at it the wrong way, it says "he is coming," but the S is sort of a silver, it's a combination.
Yes.
Because it's a male-female balance. Like all his artwork, so, you know, Bob's an artist.
So back there.
It's all about balance. And that piece in particular, the Woodstock bus, which we call it the Woodstock bus, because it was photographed at Woodstock in the original Woodstock by the Associated Press, and then that picture went all over the world and people see that VW with these two teenagers on top of it and they know immediately it's Woodstock. Well, that's Dr. Bob's bus.
And I put "She is coming" on the back of the bus because that is the place to put it if you want people to see it.
Right.
Because as you're driving along the road, it's the people behind you that get your message. And they see that. And then, of course, they talk to me about, "What is this? What's going on here? Are they taking over the world?" Well, no, they're just part of the world, just like we are as males. Because I always hear that from men on this. They're growing. We are growing, but we got a long way to go. And I admit that the same as in my life.
Yeah. You know, our previous book is about the Statue of Liberty. And we looked at it from more or less a feminist perspective and the various streams of goddess energy that went into the creation of that symbol. And, you know, that went up in 1886 at a time when, you know, why is liberty represented by a woman at a time when women had absolutely no liberty, not just liberty, but they were considered property.
Right.
You know, they didn't have rights to their children, their bodies, their income, none of it. Yeah. They were owned by their husbands or their fathers. So that's a subject that's near and dear to us. And I found it a little difficult in Yellow Submarine to find any female angle at all.
That's right.
But we did. We, you know, you can look at the Lucy in the Sky sequence, which most people, if they remember the film at all, remember that sequence. It's like eye candy. There's just so much going on. And the way they made that is quite interesting and another story in itself. But my point here is that the Lucy figure, especially as they depict it in this cartoon, can be seen as the goddess or the muse and fits right into the Joseph Campbell pattern as well. You know, she's there to inspire you, but if you stay too long, it'll pull
this
into
is the goddess.
Well, there's another way.
In the film.
There's another way.
This is the goddess.
That's the female.
She is protecting these beings, very intelligent beings, etc. But she is protecting them when they would have destroyed themselves.
Right.
And that this is because this person right here saw it long before me. And yet, this is what I'm so excited about, because I was looking for, where are the women?
Right.
Hey, that sounds like...
That's out of our book too, yes. Our earlier book. The Native Americans said, I like that story actually. Mm-hmm. When the Native Americans were teaching our Euro-American founders how to rule democratically, we got our constitution basically from the League of the Iroquois. These English people were over here trying to figure out how to remove themselves from the monarchy. And they learned how to govern themselves by watching how the native people here were doing it. And the one thing that they, well, one of the things, the important things that they didn't take from the native cultures was the respect for women and the women who were in charge. So you hear this story. It's a direct quote from some of the Native Americans when they're sitting around the council teaching these new people how they do it. Where are your women? How can you possibly think of governing without your women? You need your women here to especially decide when to go to war, because those are the ones who will be much more conservative about going to war, the ones who birth the soldiers. Absolutely. It makes common sense. So they put the women in charge of deciding when to go to war, when to negotiate peace. A whole nother topic. But in any case, we were looking for that angle, and if you look hard enough, you can find it.
Yeah, so tell me more about that. Yeah, the Yellow Submarine, how did we determine, what were the connections there to womanhood?
Well, yellow and submarine, if you start from just the basic understanding of what it is, why is it yellow? You know, in submarine warfare time, you would never paint a submarine yellow. It's all about being stealthy. But for some reason, when Paul dreamed this song, again, Paul McCartney dreamed a lot of songs. They came from the dream world. He woke up one morning with the idea of that phrase, "We all live in a yellow submarine," came to him just like that. And he started thinking about it. Maybe it would make a nice children's song, and he would make it in a neutral register so that Ringo could sing it, because he didn't have the greatest voice. So we break it down to yellow. Paul said it's just a cheery color. That's why he wanted to make it yellow. But Bob says yellow means...
Well, it's yellow is intelligence, especially higher intelligence. Because of the color, it's also divine wisdom. So that to me has always been feminine. So I think that that's where it fits in so well in regards to where we're headed in the future. With the vice president we have, and with all the other women that are involved, you can best believe this is going to be the best 3 or 4 years our nation has ever seen.
Yeah.
Fair.
Just by having more women in power.
Correct. Yeah. And honest. There are some dishonest women somewhere around the world.
No, there's quite a few of them. It doesn't mean
they exist. Yeah.
Not a genetic thing. Yeah. But anyway, submarine is sub means under, marine means water. So it's underwater. But water is a symbolic for the emotional world or the astral plane. In certain cases, this submarine flies through the air more often than it flies through the water. Or maybe it's not air. We don't know quite what it is. Some kind of ether space. But if you combine the two, you've sort of got a combination of opposites again. You've got this expansive yellow color of mind and this underwater emotional thing. So a combination of yellow plus submarine means sort of steer clear of your emotions, stay in your upper mind and your upper...
That's the key, steering clear of emotions.
Yeah.
We do not use our minds when we have so much technology going around the world as we're heading toward 5G and what that could do and destroy in consciousness. And this is one of the things that scares me a lot about technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking more now about the yellow submarine as woman, as representation of woman. And my thoughts went right to how generally in society, we relate like vehicles, technologies to women. So like if oftentimes men would, call their, vehicles a her or she, and how that also would then relate women to object. And although that, I see the connection that you're making, but how that also might be a problematic connection to woman as object. And that, sorry, and I don't have there's no point there. It was just, that's where my head was kind of spinning towards, I guess.
Yeah, well, that I certainly could take it that way. And ships are always she.
Right, yeah.
A submarine probably is technically a she too. And right. If we were in the Navy, we would know that.
Yeah.
the objectification of women. Sure. Yeah. If there's ever any way to do it, we'll do it.
No, it's absolutely
true. We're looking at it more of the terms of the divine protection.
Of course.
It has a mind of its own in certain mm-hmm. scenes of the movie, like in the Sea of Monsters, where it takes over to protect them with it. It sends out the cavalry, the 7th mm-hmm. Cavalry. When Ringo's lost in the Sea of Monsters, he's being chased by some Indian type of monsters, and the submarine lands and it sort of does it all by itself. And then again, in the Sea of Monsters, there's a vacuum monster that sucks everything
right.
up.
Right, yeah, and, inside out.
You're right, and this wonderful, I thought it was just so clever the way the filmmakers did this. It sucked up all the monsters around him, and then it sucked up the frame of the film itself. Oh. So that it's left in this white void, and then it sees its tail twitching behind it, and it sucks itself up. Yeah. So it goes boop, and it disappears, and the submarine is inside of it. And I remember when I first saw that, thinking, "Oh no, you know, it's disappeared. Where is it? Where's it?" And then the submarine pops out. So even though everything else disappears up its own existence, as they say, the submarine protected what was inside of it, and it brought them out into the land of nowhere, where they meet this most magical creature, the Nowhere Man, my favorite character in the film.
Yeah.
That's a whole ontological debate happening right there, that lesson of what happens in nowhere with no thing. And, you know, he's a real Nowhere Man.
Right.
You know, and the concepts of Buddhism come to play very much there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing is real. Let go of all attachments to the material world.
And you can also begin to see some of the limits of the Beatles mm-hmm. in that process, in which when Ringo gets thrown out of the yellow submarine, it took quite a while before the Beatles decide, hey, what are we going to do about this?
I know. And the decision to save him came last.
Maybe we should rescue
him. Yeah, maybe we should. Because, of course, I think it was the old man there was saying, look, just do trios.
Yeah.
You don't need to worry about this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Masculine way of looking at things rather than.
And that happened again in Nowhere Man when they were leaving and they all wanted to leave that little character behind. Oh, he's fine. Just leave him alone. He'll be fine. But Ringo has the first one to show compassion. He says, oh, can't we take him along with us? And it turns out to save them in the end. He's the key point in saving them in the plot.
Yeah.
So the decision to show compassion.
Absolutely. And of course, that's part of the sixth sense. Mm-hmm. The little guy there.
Jeremy, right? Is his name Jeremy? They called him Boob half the time, but.
is not only very intelligent, but he is the sixth sense. And the one that saves them, even though they were willing to let him die, mm-hmm. et cetera. I mean, those kind of things. And that's what I also like about the film, that it's a reality look at the Beatles. Because if you look at them carefully, there's a lot of good things they've done, but there are some things that were really rotten from in relationship to one another and how they went at one another at a certain period of time.
Right.
So they needed growth. They're not perfect, obviously, even though I know most Beatle fans think they generally are so close to it. But the actions of them elevate awareness that you just do not take advantage of other people. And when you do, you pay a price.
Yeah.
They were willing to pay their price, but without the yellow submarine, they were saved and made that allowed them to greater success,
right.
Which I think is a very good lesson.
Yeah, we can really make some deep connections to like diversity in that film, because there are very few creatures, right, that look alike. And that's really quite interesting. And the idea that you leave no one behind, I thought that was really, really cool too. And you also argue in the book that it influenced the peace movement and potentially even Woodstock. And I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that comes about mostly from the song. The song came out 2 years before the film did, in 1966, and almost immediately it started to be used by the peace movement, mm-hmm. Which was going through its own transition at the time, anti-war, anti-Vietnam movement. They were clashing, obviously, that's what you do in a protest, but they were starting to realize that they had to bring more levity to their protests. So the song came along at the perfect moment, and it's just the catchiest sort of melody. You know, as I, if I were wearing these earrings walking down the street in China somewhere, they would start singing it to me. I mean, it's something that everybody responds to and just immediately knows and likes. It just makes people feel happy.
Right.
Because basically you're saying we all live in a yellow submarine. We're all in this together.
And we're all one people.
We're all here, one people, one planet. It all, it says all that in one little refrain there. You may not be consciously thinking that when you say that, but that's what you're saying. We all, and our friends are all aboard. So the peace movement started to sing it. They started to construct these large floats, these their concept of a yellow submarine that they would use in the parades, that they were using, you know, push them off into the ocean. They took one to the March on the Pentagon, even in Washington, D.C., that was captured by the soldiers. They had a bit of a skirmish. They had a yellow submarine.
Never seen again.
They had a yellow submarine in a parade in San Francisco, and they would just start singing it spontaneously at their parades and rallies. And we have some quotes in the book from students explaining why. Because it made them feel like they're all in this together, and we're all, you know, it's an alternative to the submarines that the Navy was building. This is one that's full of light and cheer and color. So the New York Workshop on Nonviolence created a button that had a their depiction of a yellow submarine. Again, this was long before this was designed. So it's this chubby little thing with flowers coming out the top and a peace symbol in the conning tower. And we have pictures of the Beatles wearing that button at the launch of the Sgt. Pepper movement. So those were quite popular. It just resonated with people as a peace symbol, a symbol of peace. And then it started affecting the church movement. The radical church movement starting in Berkeley, California, was heavily involved in the anti-war movement. And they started a branch of churches called submarine churches, later to be called yellow submarine churches.
This is a great discovery of hers.
The popularity of the movie.
It's interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
And nobody else even paid attention to the fact that all these groups were doing these things. There were churches.
Even the animators didn't know this.
How did you make that connection? Where did you find this research?
Oh, just, you know, lots of Googling.
Okay.
Stumbling around from
the wormhole. Yeah.
And then I found somebody who'd written a dissertation on the submarine churches.
Oh, wow.
And
interviewed him.
Did they get a PhD?
He did. Yeah. On yellow submarine churches. So, you know, it spoke to people as a unifying thing, and the people trying to reform the church from within and make it more about service and
feed people.
Right. They were doing a lot of people. They did homeless shelters and drug rehab places and draft resistant places. Those were the submarine churches. So they would put these big banners of yellow submarines out there in protest for the church convocations. So the argument about it influencing Woodstock is again, subjective, but the film came out in America in November of 1968, right?
68, yes.
And Woodstock happened in August of 69.
Right.
So less than a year later, we make the argument that it planted the seed of that utopia, that parkland utopia concert aspect, you know, where everybody could get along. And Woodstock was not the first, but the biggest and the best because there was no unrest or problem of its kind, where 500,000 young people got together without any problem. You know, they had a lack of food. And what did the Blue Meanies do? They flew helicopters over the police and dropped food down and blankets and flowers. I mean, that's remarkable cooperation.
Thanks to their governor.
For some reason, they decided not to press charges on all the drug use that was happening on the field. You know, they just let it happen. And everybody who was there, despite the rain and the mud, they grooved with the music and the love and the vibe that was going on at that time of no more war. I mean, that was another big no more war type of statement that was happening throughout those 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to think that the Pepperland utopia aspect had some influence on people wanting that. And for a while there was a lot of hope that music would change the world, and that this protest movement of the young people was it did, and it changed an awful lot. There was an awful lot of social change at that time.
Until the Rolling Stones concert.
Yeah. Well, yeah, then we realize that things aren't always perfect.
That's right. But I know it's a big imperfection when you kill someone at a concert.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it wasn't the be-all, end-all of the Aquarian age. It wasn't the absolute, this is the way we're all going to behave from here on. But it was the beginning.
Of course.
You know, it was a first step. And then humanity, you know, slides back. And I think we'll slide back and forth and back and forth until we eventually grow out of our immaturity and realize that we are all one people on one planet. And we are, you know, there's no reason to go to war with each other because we're all the same. We are all Earth people.
Yeah.
So why are we fighting all the time?
And some of us might not, they might be more than just Earth people, but
no doubt.
The rest of the universe has all got itself together, but we haven't yet,
right.
But we're going to.
I believe that. Every day I meet more people who impress me, you know, with their ability to use love, you know, in really difficult times to just always express love. And I think that for me, that is an expression of hope for the future, 1,000%. And I also feel like those connections, I know that you had said, you know, the connection to women, that the book that you had wrote, and then there was also the connection to indigeneity as well that you had made. And I was thinking about that more when we speak about, you know, the earth, we're all one, right? And so I also see this connection between, you know, going back to like these indigenous, like words of wisdom and indigenous practices in terms of how we treat each other, but also how we treat the earth itself and everything that lives on the earth. And so I found a lot of really deep connections there as well when I was reading your book and watching the film. And I thought that was really, really interesting as well.
Well, it's true.
It's the Native Americans.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes, it's the Native Americans and what our president has focused on right now and giving them power in their own lands.
Mm.
This must be certainly tearing Trump apart because he hated Native Americans. He made sure that if there was ever going to be any oil going through anywhere, it was going to be through their property.
Mm.
And he failed.
It's all packaged together with respect for the earth is the mother. The mother is the earth. Respect for women, it goes together with respect for the earth. And that person had very little respect for either. So it just was dismissed as in terms of being important, whereas it is the most important thing.
Mm.
Compassion for others, which we tend to relate with a more feminine quality, and women tend to embrace that more readily, you know, more naturally. They circle around one another in times of crisis. It's just a natural thing to do. You know, you protect your young and you protect each other.
Yeah, women are our teachers.
But men can do that too. It's not to say that men can't. They have just as much ability to show compassion as women have to show fierceness and disgusting activity, right?
Yeah.
But if you look at both and you look at balance, it's all about balance because women have strengths and superiorities that men don't have. And likewise, men have strengths that women don't have. And you need both. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Native Americans understood on a fundamental level, that as Europeans coming over, we had been conditioned out of with all those years and years of patriarchy and domination control beaten into our system. That's the way we became it, at, you know, dominate the earth. That was what we're taught in our church was, you know, from the story of Adam and Eve, where you're taught to dominate, and that men are superior to women. But that's the fundamental mistake, really, in terms of how we're approaching the world today.
Absolutely.
We have to get out of that mindset and back to nature.
Yeah. And see that fluidity between all of us. I think that that's really the most important piece. And this might be a little bit of a side piece, but thinking about, you know, all of these, you know, things I'm hearing right now about how women have to be a bit more aggressive in the workforce, right? And like not using exclamation points in their emails and, you know, not being too passive in meetings. And that is what it is. But in my mind, we should be doing the reverse in the workplace, is ensuring that people are more empathetic in the workplace and listen more in the workplace. And so I always find that really interesting that we, you know, in order to make these changes, we encourage women to behave more masculine, when
right.
I think in reality, there needs to be more of a blending of all of it. Like there needs to be less rigid lines between these behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Absolutely. I think you're absolutely on the right spot there. Men should be more feminine, if we're going to call it feminine and masculine. Even the labels are wrong to begin
right,
with.
Right.
Right. You bring women to the table and then let them lead the way they are programmed to lead.
Right.
You know, you need to bring more cooperation, more partnership, and that's the tendency of women is to try to find a solution, whereas men try to be right. just in generalities, very broad strokes of stereotypes.
The way that we're socialized is exactly what I'm getting from that. Yeah, 100%. Which all of this is kind of bringing me to the London piece that you had chatted about in the book as well. So you write that there was something kind of weird and magical happening in London in the late 1960s. And Hines, the film designer, was not the only one who believed that the Yellow Submarine could not have been made anywhere else. So not in LA or Rome or Outer Mongolia. And Hines really wanted you to understand how formative the weird and magical neighborhood of Soho was to the look of the Yellow Submarine. And I just wonder what that connection was.
Oh, go ahead on that.
Swinging London is quite famous for that time period. And we have to remember that the Yellow Submarine was made during the Summer of Love. It came to be known as the Summer of Love in the heart of swinging London. So that was the epicenter of change. You know, the fashions were changing, the music was changing. Everybody's social ideas of what was acceptable was changing. Hair was getting longer. Skirts were getting shorter. Very cloth fashions. The mini skirt was born. So we tell the story of these young people, some of them coming from Australia, South Africa, Spain, all over the place, and ending up in London and thinking, oh my goodness, I've got to cut off inches off my dresses. That was one of the first reactions. Yeah. Of these. And, you know, another one was concerned about her flabby thighs because she suddenly had to show them. And, oh, my goodness, they're wearing Indian clothes. This is so strange. Everything was just so strange and different and lovely. And then the animation industry is centered in an area called Soho in London, which is also the home of a lot of the pornography trade. So they have a lot of strip clubs there, a lot of gangsters rubbing shoulders with filmmakers. It's a very strange mixture. The artsy fartsy crowds were drawn to that place. A lot of jazz clubs, a lot of just the most unusual people were drawn there. So they had a lot of street buskers who were very unusual, very eccentric. And we have some pictures of them. We fortunately found pictures of the actual people that the Yellow Submarine crew members remember seeing as they were walking to and from work, you know, dancing in the middle of the street, balancing wine bottles on their heads, singing Beatles tunes, or tap dancing with a baby's carriage, singing When I'm 64. And one of the reasons that the Beatles were not more involved in the making of this film is at the same time they were finishing up their own film, Magical Mystery Tour. Mm-hmm. So they kind of saw it as competition until they later saw it and realized how good it was. So they were there too. They were in Soho, especially Paul, who took the most interest in his film, editing their film just a few blocks away from where they were making The Yellow Submarine. So, you know, as you're walking down the streets, you see these strippers walking back and forth from the various clubs they're dancing in. And you know that line in the song that Paul wrote, she said she'd always been a dancer, worked at 15 clubs a day. That's what he saw. That's where they were. So that's the kind of thing that these people were seeing every day. It was just a weird, magical place full of creativity and bums sleeping it off in the streets. So it was a strange mixture of things. And as Heinz said, there was this sense of unreality, a blithe sense of unreality. Mm-hmm. It was just, that was your everyday. That was every day.
It was like an artist's life.
Yeah.
Because, excuse me, most artists, when we get going, are extremely poor, and it takes them quite a while to learn that how to eat, because most of us lived on one meal a day for months.
Right.
And that kind of thing. And I'm sure the same thing about the artists that created this film. Also, many of them were just hanging in there. And this job came along and saved their life. It changed the lives of every one of them. Would you say that?
Oh, yeah. A number of them say it was the best year of their lives. It was a magical coherence of just the coming together. People from all over the world. People who've never worked together with people who had worked together on the TV series for years. So there were close-knit units with people who had never met, and they just fell together. It was a perfect storm of creative energy and minds, with the one distraction of the American producers who just couldn't get over the idea of turning it into just a money-making machine. And he finally did let them have control with a number of interesting stories that we don't have time for, but you know, other than that, everybody got along so incredibly well. It was a magical year.
It was egoless. Mm-hmm. For a group of artists to become egoless in some of the best of the United Kingdom, that is something. Because, you know, when you finally make your mark, so to speak, in the art world, you are full of ego. It's automatic because so many people are coming up and say, thought you never make it, you know, and then you realize that my heavens, you did, you know, but artists have to go through this all the time. And one of the things I love about how this young lady, where she took everything, is that she went to document everything precisely, because she understood that in my life, most of my work, if it's not, wasn't documented, no one would believe it.
Yeah.
No one would believe most of the experiences that I've had, but those are the kind of experiences almost all artists have, because you take whatever you could get and make sure that you got enough to eat.
Right.
I emphasize that because that's where a lot of these artists had their problems, even working on the Yellow Submarine at first. Many of them still weren't eating, but they've learned how to eat eventually.
Good. I find most of the artists that I know are still struggling to learn to eat, unfortunately. but I've noticed and it just popped into my head now. There's a chapter you wrote called A Most Unusual Plot Summary. And in the chapter, you reference the fashion fad of the thigh-high boots and how it made its way into the film in the Sea of Monsters with the kinky boot beasts. And in my head, I thought, oh, maybe that's another like a womanhood representation as well in the film that I hadn't made until we had this conversation. Interesting. And that was my favorite part of the film. And I couldn't really grasp why. I just thought it was so incredible. And now I kind of see that connection a little bit.
Yeah. The kinky boot beasts. Heinz Edelman loved the Sea of Monsters. Monsters was his thing. He was so fed up with the way the producers were trying to make the film with the stupid scripts, let's say the silly humor scripts, that they went through one script after another, which was extremely challenging for the animators with nothing to animate. So finally one day he sat down and he said, I'm just gonna draw what I wanna draw. And it turned out to be the Sea of Monsters. So it's a 6-minute segment in the film with no Beatles music at all. It's quite unusual, but full of these fascinating combinations of household items. You know, there's a teapot monster. Just, you know, weird roly-poly things and the vacuum monster. And he had a way of creating creatures out of common everyday things and sort of anthropomorphizing them, I guess.
Right, yeah, and giving life to these objects, I guess, like we were talking about before, right? Giving life to objects that we generally think have no consciousness.
Right, they have consciousness. Your shoes have consciousness. Yeah, you better watch out because they'll stomp on you.
Did you have big boots when you're a long time ago? Or now?
Did you ever have
some big boots? I've had some big boots for sure. Yeah. Now the height comes from the heel, not the length, but.
Yeah, that was sort of an accommodation for the very short skirts that the women started wearing at the time. That's when the boots came in. And some of the young women working on the film remember going out and buying their first pair of thigh-high boots. It was all the rage.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I wonder, so this has just kind of popped into my head as well, but you had said that there were so many people working on the film and you sort of spoke to this a little bit, but I wonder, like, what was there conflict in terms of the stories that you gathered in this new book from the people that you hadn't heard from in the first book? Like, did the stories align to some extent or did they, were they conflictual sometimes? And how did you navigate that?
Well, I think they were not, conflictual.
No, for the most part, everybody remembers the same thing, except for Al Brodax.
Well, yes.
Al Brodax's version of this film and the making of this film is completely different from everybody else's.
Okay.
Well, he wrote a book on it.
He wrote his own memoir, which is fiction, basically.
Wow.
He took a lot of Bob's earlier book and rewrote it in his own perspective and put all the good quotes in his mouth. It was just a blatant bad thing to do.
But the fortunate thing about that is that the crew of the Yellow Submarine saw that and decided to tell the truth, which they did. And I'm sure it must have crushed Al Brodax, but we had to do it.
Yeah.
Everybody came out and said, you lied about this. You lied about, and he was lying, making things up. Like, who is that other artist that does that all the time?
Peter Max.
Peter Max.
there were a few discrepancies every once in a while, but they were minor and we like to include them anyway. You know, this is how I remember it happening. And then right below that, someone else's quote, well, this is how I remember it happening. Because we can't tell, we weren't there. Right. If they can't remember 50 years later, you know, what's to say anybody else would know? Mm-hmm. And there was no record keeping. So when you get down to some of the factual questions of who designed what and who came up with what line here and there, you just have to go with what people remember best. And okay. So, you know, three or four people remember coming up with the line, are you bluish? You don't look bluish. You know, I think three people said, I remember coming up with that line.
Oh, right.
We just let them say that. Okay. If you, maybe you did, who knows?
Well, it's a collaborative effort at the end of the day, like, you know, and so that might be part of the problem. Like someone started the sentence, someone finished it. And that's also true. The trouble with historical retellings, right? But that's also kind of the beauty of it.
That's true.
Right.
Means something to me because I grew up, there's nine people in my family, there's seven kids. So we spent a lot of time in front of the television. And of course the hottest show at the time was The Simpsons. And you mentioned that The Simpsons were influenced by the Yellow Submarine. And I was just really curious about those connections.
Mm-hmm. Oh, please share.
Well, a lot of animators that we know today were influenced by Yellow Submarine in a lot of ways, mainly when they saw it, it was the first cartoon or feature film rather made for adults as well as children. So the script, for example, has a lot of witty puns that you're not going to get unless you really listen carefully and you're an adult and you have something to reference it to. And a lot of that is from the professor of classics I mentioned, Eric Siegel, who wrote a lot of those, but Roger McGough, who is a very well-known poet in England. He also wrote most of those witty Liverpool type of jokes. And, you know, they saw it as something that could be done for adults. That was the main innovative spur that a lot of people will talk about. They'll just watch it over and over again for ideas of innovation. And it's different. It's not Disney. That was all anybody knew for feature length films, was this beautiful artwork, but not very funny. And that's what the creator of The Simpsons says a lot about. Well, you know, there was Disney, there was Mickey Mouse, but I always thought he was so bland. He's certainly not funny. And then all of a sudden there was Submarine, and it's funny and it's grown up. And, you know, it's not like they copied the style. People tried to copy the style, but they didn't do a very good job. And I think that's because you really needed Heinz Edelman and a pressure cooker type of environment to recreate it. There was never a film made like it. A lot of people say that the Monty Python style animation was influenced by it. And he's admitted that as well. Terry Gilliam, who did the animation for Monty Python, particularly the cutout style montage work that you see at the beginning with Eleanor Rigby mixing real media photographs with animation. That's what Monty Python excelled at. But it's the people who made the video for Oasis's song All Around the World, they deliberately did a Yellow Submarine montage. A homage, I should say.
That's really well done.
Yeah. You know, they talked about watching the movie over and over and over again, just to get something that they could sort of feed into their own creativity. So that's how it influenced many of the animators today. John Lasseter is a huge Yellow Submarine fan, the founder of Pixar.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
There's also, have you seen the show Rick and Morty?
No, I'm familiar with it, but I haven't seen it.
Okay. When I read the bit about The Simpsons, I started seeing the influence in Rick and Morty, and I don't know if there actually is. Like, I've watched interviews with the creators and I haven't seen anything said, but there are so many like diverse monsters, and there's also time warps, and it's very scientifically based. And the whole like kind of theory of the show is that nothing matters. Like, there's multiple universes. We exist in multiple universes. Our decisions don't really matter for that reason. But the disconnect is that the scientist in the cartoon also believes then that our relationships with people don't necessarily matter. But he battles that the entire show as well. And so I do wonder if there's a connection there, and perhaps there is unintentionally, but even like the different aliens and monsters that you meet in the show are just so similar to the Yellow Submarine, not necessarily, but you know, the creative pieces where you couldn't even imagine, you know, these types of monsters that you see. That it just started really getting me to start seeing these connections that perhaps we haven't even made in the creations that we're delivering, but are there just inherently, right?
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. The concept of parallel universes is a real mind bender, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. That,
you know, every decision you make may have branched you off into another reality. That's right. Just hard to understand. But actually, that concept is addressed in the Yellow Submarine film.
Right. It's introduced entirely. And that moment when time starts moving backwards, exactly. And then they almost disappear. And then that was the moment I fell in love with
it. In another universe submarine.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Going backwards in time. Yeah.
It was really a really smart film. And
that was ahead of its time, before people were actually talking about parallel universes.
Exactly. Exactly. And I guess that's maybe why people made the connection to LSD. Like, we hadn't been talking about it enough. So.
Well, there's that, you know, people, as soon as the song came out, people were like, well, what is a yellow submarine? It must be a drug. Of course, the Beatles are telling us to take more drugs. They make that leap whenever they can. The Beatles songs lyrics, as you know, have been analyzed inside out and upside down. Yeah. So there was a popular drug at the time that was in a yellow capsule, a barbiturate that they called the yellow submarine. So they said, okay, there's the yellow submarine. It's a drug and it's supposed to take you to Pepperland, make you high. But the people who made the film absolutely were not taking drugs. You cannot be high while you're doing the precise work that's required for animation. It's just not possible. They drank a lot.
There's
an awful lot of the neighborhood pub, but that was the only drug of choice. The art students that they bust in overnight shift to do the filling in the lines of the paint, they were probably smoking, but not, you know, it wasn't as big as people make out. It wasn't a huge drug party. Those are the stories that Al Brodeck liked to tell before Bob started publishing his research. You know, he was the only one talking about it. So he hyped it up and made it sound like everybody was having sex under the tables and all these babies were being born. And yeah, there was a little bit of that, but it wasn't the way that you might like to think, that it was this drug-crazed sex orgy. Mm-hmm. You know, people are all about taking drugs, because it wasn't. These were very conservative, actual artists who were just doing their job. Just
and many of them got married and had children.
True. That's another
during
story.
The process, during the process of this film.
That's true. There were, five 50-year marriages.
Wow.
That came out of that
years.
Film.
That's incredible.
Lifelong marriages. Yes.
Wow.
So absolute love stories.
You're not going to do that on LSD.
Right.
And then
that's true. That'd be tough to maintain.
Lovely love stories.
that's
magical. To see the children that they would bring their children in.
Yeah, they called them yellow sub bubs.
Oh.
They were little babies around the studio. We have a picture of one of them in the book. In fact, he got a copy of the book. He's my age now. He's in his 50s. But, you know, they were there in 1968 as a little baby born on the set.
That's so incredible. It makes me kind of feel the type of energy that would have been in the room when they were designing this movie and creating it. Like there would have been like a close relationship, and that element of love, I imagine, even though it was very stressful, quite obviously, that they also built some really magical relationships within that. And I think that you can kind of see that in the film a little bit.
Yes, I think so. That comes through. That love that you feel pouring out of the screen into you, that's coming from a real place. They were really, really happy with what they were doing. They loved the Beatles. They love the message of the times of, you know, love is all you need. They were really heart and soul behind that. Right. And many of them were loving each other at the same time. They were falling in love and creating families. So it's real. It's a true love. It's a real love that we all feel.
And especially this group of people working together, because they were a family.
Mm.
They were, this is not an exaggeration. They became a family because of the length of time that they spent in to literally working in higher states of consciousness while they were there. And that really is a major thing to consider. Before we did this book 2, we were not aware that there was such a big family. We were only looking in the beginning at the big guys, the big guys that got it rolling and going. But we didn't know anything about who was keeping it going, who were the people that really made the difference, that did the drawings, and what the different experiences they had. That's why I think this book is so much more important than the first book, because it tells you more about what the film really is about. It's about everybody and a family that worked together and loved together and created something that is 50 years old. 50 years old, and yet there are so many people that have yet to see it. But it's just wonderful every time I introduce it to someone who's 3 or 4 years old, which used to be a great hobby of mine. I used to went out and bought about, maybe 20 VHSs on it and 20, DVDs. And whenever I found a child or a family that never saw the film, give them one. And that way it changed their entire life and the family's life.
Yeah,
because they realized that this wasn't just a thing to let them watch that would get them out of their hair, that actually would help in their development. Yeah. Looking out,
as love is all you need. Because yes, fundamentally, that is true. Love is all you need.
Yeah, the film is kind of life altering. It does change you. Just even in the moment of watching it, you enter that world, and it's really quite magical. And my whole body felt it. Like I wasn't. It was like a stimulus entirely. And it's so. I mean, I completely agree. I'm like eager to introduce it to all my nieces and nephews and make sure that they watch it, because I think, you know, it's such a rich piece of history that somehow has not lost relevance or importance, and nothing has surpassed it. You know, for me, it's like I've never seen anything like it still. And that's so incredible with all the technology that we have. And I know that it's influenced the technology we have today and how we film and design film, but it's still nothing is like it. And I think that that's really quite incredible and rare.
Right. It's not dated. There's nothing that it holds up very well. Yeah. And a lot of the success is due to the Beatles music being so infectious and harmonious and about love, the love poetry, and it's, you know, a groove you can dance to. So it's a wonderful vehicle for that. It was when they were at their height of their Sgt. Pepper era, when it was all lovely and peace and, you know, let's do this. We can do this. We can all get along. Right. And everything, and everybody was beautiful.
Yeah.
In that moment in time.
Yeah, it's very hopeful. It's very hopeful.
It is.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously I recommend the film. Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
I think it's good. It's our future, because we're going to do it again. We're going to put it back together. Yeah. There are people a lot smarter than I am that are now getting turned on to the fact that we can change things.
Right.
We don't have to remain in the same little house. And I mean a physical house, right. But you can expand your consciousness and learn and have a new love for learning. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that have been kind of lost in recent decades is the reason why I am always a student is because I always want to learn new stuff. Mm. It's like the first time I showed something to what my teacher, and that would be Heinz Edelman. He wanted to know, Bob, why are you wasting your time painting a car? And I would say, it's the only thing I had to paint. Mm-hmm. That I had a story that I wanted to tell, and I could have written it down on pieces of paper, no one would read it. But if you're in a car and you paint a car like that, that tells that story, you're riding around town and you're elevating consciousness and awareness, especially when other people say, hey, I know what that means. Mm. It's a symbol of we're all one people on one planet and we can make it together.
Yeah.
Sounds corny, but it's not.
Yeah.
it works. It does work.
It does. Yeah. I think that only makes sense. Yeah. And I just want to thank you both for writing both books, but this book in particular, like I think it really complemented the film in a way that I hadn't, you know, seen anything else complemented before. And so thank you for writing it. I think that it was a mission worthwhile. And I need to do a deeper delve into it and read it twice. I think, you know, like you miss all the things in between, and the things I was catching were just the things that kind of were remarkable to me in the film, but I need to give it a second read. And I recommend everyone listening to give it a read as well. It was an incredible book, really, really incredibly written and thoughtful as well. And respectfully, like I think you've told stories so respectfully. And I think that that's a really difficult thing to do. And you did it. So thank you.
Thank you for appreciating that.
Yeah.
I'll just say self-promotion, yellowsubmarinebook.com. Currently that's the only place to find the book is from our website. Couldn't be simpler. yellowsubmarinebook.com.
Yeah. And we'll put the link as well.
Thank you.
Could I mention something?
Please.
In regard to, I liked your idea of finally, if we have time, here are a few questions I'll ask at the end of the interview. And I did my homework.
Okay. Are we ready? We can play that game.
Okay. So my dream artist to work with would be Joseph W. Turner in his watercolor work. Just otherworldly, just extraordinary. If I had a magic power, what I would do is use it for healing.
Oh, that's a good one.
If I could remake any movie star in it, it would be the film Being There with Peter Sellers. You know, the gardener who always reminded me of George Harrison, because George Harrison was heavily into gardening. And Peter Sellers, it was so, he was just not that kind of person, but he grew up because of that particular film. I mean, he was a tough guy. Peter Sellers would be the kind of guy to go out and borrow a Rolls Royce, drive it around, and never bring it back. No, he was very careless. But he took that work seriously when it had to do with gardens and things of that nature. And the last one is, one way to shine light online is you can send visual light to others. Think of them, see them engrossed in it, you know, living within it, especially blues, greens, yellows, pinks, etc. Pinks especially, because that's just love right there. And over a period of time, you can heal people that way. I know that no doctor is going to say that's good, but I
like that. I hadn't thought of that in terms of how to shine light online, send people light through the internet. I had never thought of, you know, my thought was always, of course, with all the haters out there, you know, and you try not to fall into that, and you post positive stuff, you know, but we do that anyway, just in our daily lives, in pre-pandemic time, when you're walking down the street and you've got a homeless person there, you know, not only give them some money, but send them light. You visualize, you hold them in light and put a blue light around them or whatever, you know, just do that. I do that as I'm driving by anybody that I see that I think needs help. But I hadn't thought about doing that if I'm online and I'm offended by something or somebody I see happening online. They're there, they're in a virtual universe, but they're also there. And it doesn't matter if you're physically with them, you can still send people light all the time. It's a great medicinal healing practice.
Right. Yeah. No, of course. Laura, I just wanted to make sure that if you wanted to answer the questions that you could answer them as well.
Dream artist. I decided I was going to bring back the Statue of Liberty. There's this woman who was contemporary with the artist who made the Statue of Liberty. Her name was Edmonia Lewis. Okay. And she was a Native American, African-American, free woman. And she's the first woman to be trained in Rome in classical sculpture. And she made a name for herself as a sculptor and as an artist. And so if I would ever, I wouldn't want to work with her necessarily, but I'd like to watch, you know, and watch how, what it was like to be such a different person in that time period when it was so hard for any woman to make a name for herself, to actually succeed in an academic field. And she sculpted things that were empowering for women. She sculpted powerful women and regular women doing powerful things. So that's pretty cool.
That Edmonia Lewis. Okay. I've written it down. I'll look into it. That's cool.
Yeah. It's worth a Wikipedia check for the day. If I had a magic power, I would like to be able to control the weather, just because we could use that in all areas. It's just a very, very dangerous power to have, because it puts the judgment in your hands of where that energy needs to go, because you can't just dissipate energy. It has to go somewhere. So figuring out a place that needs it better would be probably more than I could responsibly take on. But if I could make any movie, I would just go for Yellow Submarine.
Okay.
About a Yellow Submarine movie. I wouldn't want to necessarily star in it, but I would like to see them be able to make it in the same type of situation. Like I said, it has to have that pressure cooker of intense intensity to make it work the way it did, and yet somehow magically extend that, you know, in a parallel universe type of way, so that they could have the amount of time and the extra budget that they wanted to finish the few particular scenes that they ran out of time and budget to do the way they wanted. I would love to be able to see that happen. Because of the conflict with the suits and the budget, they ran out of money. So the end of the film in particular is stuck together with sticky tape, literally. That's what makes all those reflective colors in the background. It was this prismatic effect that one of the innovators found, if you put it through a certain filter, made this lovely change color thing. But they had a different thing in mind for that, that was going to be much more elaborate. Yeah. That would have been just wonderful to see. Right. And Shine Light Online, I already mentioned that. I think I'm going to do what you do. I'm going to send people light now, consciously.
Yeah.
Some need for that, because there's never enough light in the world. We need to shed light everywhere, always send light.
I love that. I think you're the only two that I've ever actually said that and like taken that literally. And I think that it's also like the most simple, but also most like profound, you know, idea I've heard so far. And so anyway, thank you both so much for coming on the show. It was so incredible to learn from both of you.
Thank you. It's delightful to be interviewed by a sparkling wit. Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe someday we'll talk about Mr. Hendricks and all those.
I would love that. We can have a part two.
He was just totally different than most people ever knew.
Yeah.
Well, you'd be walking, I would walk down the street with him and he'd see a little kid on the side of the road, 16, 18 year old person, and he's crying, and Jimmy going over to him, putting his hand on him. And that sounds like it's very interesting, but you know, he's got bosses and his bosses are watching him and they're saying, you cannot do this, Jimmy. You must keep walking. Do not stop here. And he'd turn around and say, I got something to focus on here. He focused on it, then got up and the people that he did this with didn't know who he was.
It's fascinating. Now we have to have you on again. What a cliffhanger.
Well, anyway, unfortunately, most people don't know him from that perspective, but he has been given a bad bill of goods, because had they known him, and we do know his sister, she's been on our show a number of times on 21st Century Radio. Maybe someday you could have her on to talk about that time period, because he was the most unusual person I ever met. Mm. He'd fight for his meals, which is usually a half a sandwich somewhere, fighting a rat to get it. I mean, he went through the same things I did. And, you know, that's what happens literally with, if you're going to take chances, then you're going to be the only person doing it, and there's nobody else to turn to, kind of thing.
My gosh, it'd be interesting to have both you and her on the show to talk about it. I feel like that would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, let's talk about that. Well, thanks again to both of you, and we'll be in touch soon.
Okay.
Au revoir.
Bye.
I spoke French.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love to hear what you think and anything more or less that you'd like to learn about. Comment here, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jamilee.baroud, jamilee.baroud. Until next time, shine light online, and I'll talk to you soon.